to you.
All right, it's nice to have you here today. I'm not sure who the justice is. I think it's Justice Karofsky. You're lucky. She's great. You're going to hear from her afterwards. She won't talk to you about the facts of this case, but she can answer any questions that you might have for her. So we look forward to, and make them tough, I often add.
But no questions that Justice Robin said.
She likes to.
The high bench.
All right. Go ahead and have a seat, and it's nice to have you here today. All right, Colleen, Lowe's Home Center versus City of Delavan, 19 AP, 1987. Could I please start with your appearances? All right, good morning.
Good morning, I'm Attorney Daniela Bolivantieri of Axley Attorneys, also present with co-counsel, Mr. Irony, and Gordon Linsky for the defendant's office.
Morning.
Good morning, Amy Seidel. I'm representing the Amici in this case, the legal standard in this balance.
Okay, good morning. The lineup I have is 25 minutes, followed by 20, 10, and then 5 minutes in rebuttal, correct? All right, let's proceed then.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Daniel Devaney from Frederickson and Byron on behalf of Plaintiff Appellant Petitioner at Lowe's Home Centers, LLC. The case before the court is a real property excessive assessment appeal, specifically regarding the 2016 and 2017 assessments of Lowe's real property, a big box retail property, located in the city of Delavan. I intend to focus this presentation this morning primarily on the primary issue before the court, one that was brought to the floor by the Court of Appeals, the primary focus of the party's briefing and the amicus briefing, one of recognized statewide importance, and that is what has been ominously labeled by some as the dark store issue or the dark store debate. We submit that that label is both strategic and to an extent misleading. To clarify what Lowe's seeks in this matter and what it does not seek, it does not seek any inordinate or improper reduction of assessment or taxes. It does not seek any special rule that would be applied to any property, this or any other, in any context. It's not seeking some assumption that its properties be valued as though they're derelict or dilapidated.
I think the dark store issue is very interesting, but I'm interested in what specific evidence did Lowe's put in to show that the assessment was excessive?
I'm sure, Your Honor. So I can address within this context, Your Honor, there's two means by which the presumption of correctness either is not accorded or overcome. It's either significant contrary evidence is presented, or if the assessment was not made in accordance with the manual and Wisconsin law. So the evidence in this case, Your Honor, was tier two. The focus of the primary issue is tier two valuation evidence, which is sales comparison approach, Your Honor. And that evidence was offered by Lowe's expert, Mr. Michael Maroos. The way that this dark store issue came up, Your Honor, was that the sales that...
Kate, I understand the dark store issue, and I think it's very interesting. But I'd like to know what specific evidence was presented that shows that the assessment was excessive. Excessive is the word that troubles me, and I couldn't find any evidence that was presented by Lowe's that showed it was excessive. So I'm thinking I probably missed it, which is why I ask you the question.
Sorry, Your Honor. So that was in the testimony and appraisal of Mr. Michael Maroos. He conducted actually several the different analyses, Tier 2 and Tier 3. His Tier 2 analyses utilized six comparable sales to measure the fee simple value of Lowe's property, and then the Tier 3 evidence, it used cost approach, income approach. But because of the Markarian hierarchy, the Tier 2 was relied on, and the appraisal conclusion from that was $4.6 million, Your Honor. And the primary issue on appeal is the Court of Appeals ruling, a perceived rule of law that it derived from bond stores that we think is contrary to fundamental principles of Wisconsin law, Your Honor, that it's a bright line categorical disqualification of those sales because they were vacant. They did not have an operating business at the time of the sale. And we think that that does, it clearly does not comply with fundamental principles affirmed by this court in the unanimous decision, Walgreen versus City of Madison.
So Walgreens was a very different case. Walgreens was assessed at what the owner made on it. And so the Walgreens focused on the contract issue, not just the value of the real estate. I really think Walgreens is not on point, counsel.
Understood, Justin Rogensack. Respectfully, I think that it is. So the specific issue in Walgreen that needed to be resolved was it was an income approach valuation, whether contract rents, market rents, basically whether Walgreens lease skewed the value above fee simple market value. And then the court also determined whether, as a threshold matter, it should be fee simple value or leased fee value. But the starting point, Your Honor, was these fundamental principles, and that's the statute, the substantive statute, that's to the legislature, section 70.32, parent 1. Mm-hmm. And that says that the substantive standard is all real property should be assessed at full value, which could ordinarily be obtained, therefore, at a private sale. And the court confirmed that that means what's being valued and what needs to be valued is no more than the market value of the fee simple interest in real property. The Walgreen Madison Court affirmed the holding in Flood that the statute prescribes assessing real property in excess of market value. Real property being essentially the land and improvements, the sticks and the dirt, and the rights that come along with it. And that's it, not business value that is attributable to any business operating on the property. And the way that it manifested in that case, Justice, was that the business value was in the form of the particular arrangement with Walgreen under the lease. The way that these principles, these fundamental principles led to that, and these fundamental principles, Your Honor, they came from a Tier 1 case, which was Flood, a Tier 2 case, which was Flint Building. So there's different methodologies, but the fundamental principles of what needs to be valued applies to all of those. And in our briefing, Your Honor, we addressed how, starting from these fundamental principles, there is a Court of Appeals decision, Walgreen versus Oshkosh, that said, yeah, this is business valuation, effectively saying that if there is not a business operating on the property, that in and of itself is not a real property attribute and does not dictate or mean anything of the property value itself. And that the court said, in order to use it, we would need to adjust vacant comparables to bring it up to the subject property. And so that was an application of that principle of this context. And there's citations to other jurisdictions, Your Honor, that have started from that same starting point, the same fundamental principle, fee simple real property valuation, and how that does apply to this. So we think that that is a natural and inescapable extension of Walgreen Madison to this context. And to clarify Justice.
Yeah, what is the addition to fee simple that you're asserting to us is within the valuation that was placed on Lowe's?
So the problem, Your Honor, is the bright line rule where it's how the law in this case is the fundamental legal principles. And the problem is that the wrong principles were applied to evaluating the sales comparison evidence. The specific holding by the Court of Appeals that pervaded its decision and provide the basis to affirm the circuit court and embrace the city's assessor was that vacant properties, just by virtue of vacancy, that there is no business operating on them, that is categorically disqualifying. And those are, I'd submit, clear statements of law that the Court of Appeals applied. And to clarify what our primary argument is on the dark store issue, Your Honor, is just that bright line rule, that categorical prohibition is not proper, and this area doesn't generally lend itself to that.
Did your expert provide other opportunities for valuation except stores that were dark or vacant?
So, Your Honor, in the Tier 2 analysis, all the stores were vacant at the time they sold, and we addressed this in the briefing, Your Honor, how that's a characteristic when there is, particularly for owner-occupied properties where this usually comes up, it's a characteristic of a sale. It will be vacant because the entire bundle of rights is passing. And we're not saying that you ignore the fact that it's vacant, but the vacancy itself does not adhere to the real property. It doesn't necessarily mean that the real property cannot be compared. It's not that, to refer back to another portion of our briefing, there's elements of comparison where the manual says this is how you compare real property attributes and how a comparable sale compares to a subject property. And whether it's vacant or occupied at any particular time with a business is not a proper element under that. So that's the issue, Your Honor, is that the principles applied, and we're not requesting that the court direct any particular result or outcome of this case, but the fundamental principles that were applied, they do not square with fee simple valuation, as this court said in Walgreen-Madison. So that's our basic position on the primary issue.
Counsel, is there any part of the manual that you're challenging? Do you think any part of the manual is inconsistent with Wisconsin law?
So, Justice Hagedorn, I think that we reference the parts of the manual that are consistent, but I think the only part that would be potentially inconsistent is the manual's commentary on the Bonstores case. And we addressed it's a court of appeals decision. It can't overrule principles that were affirmed in Walgreen-Madison. And if you look at that, the Bonstores case, we don't think stands or should be interpreted for that bright-line legal rule. And it's the statements that the Court of Appeals seized upon here, we think are vague and don't stand for that. There were discrete factual issues in that case, and we don't challenge that truly distressed sales cannot be used either. But the only manual provision that would, I guess, warrant this category or potentially even indicate support for what the Court of Appeals applied is commentary on that Bonstores case. So it's derivative of Bonstores.
Sure. So you're comfortable with the idea that that dark stores, which are described in the manual as stores that are, you know, on the market for a longer period of time, trial court relied upon your experts' definition of kind of within that market what might be too long, excluded a couple of properties on that basis, and the manual suggests those should not be used. I understand you're making some arguments that the trial court made some erroneous findings of fact. But putting that argument aside for a moment, do you see any legal error in that conclusion if you accept the trial court's findings of fact?
I'm sorry, what conclusion, Justice?
Just the conclusion that for example, the two properties that were on the market for a longer period of time, according to the trial court's findings, that those were excluded. I mean, this case largely is about the trial court making some factual findings.
Yeah,
right.
So, Justice, I think that there was improper summary dismissal of the comparable sales. The elements of comparison weren't considered, weren't applied. I think that is an okay, that is something that can be considered. The vacancy, how long it is, you never ignore the realities of that exist for a property or any other property. That conclusion is somewhat different from what the Court of Appeals applied.
Sure. I understand your argument with the Court of Appeals and maybe some of its framing over what's vacant versus what's, you know, what's dark, but and obviously it was a per curiam decision. It wasn't even citable. So generally speaking, we're reviewing, you know, here. We're looking at the trial court's work. I mean, we're looking at the Court of Appeals too, to a certain extent, but the trial court makes some factual findings. The trial court excludes the six properties and says they're not, you know, in compliance with the statute, looking at arm's length, reasonably comparable properties, and therefore discredits your expert. Again, right or wrong, and I know you make some arguments, it was some poor factual findings here, but you don't have a problem theoretically with the idea that there are dark properties that have been on the market vacant for a longer period of time, and that those the manual instructs that those are properly and should generally be excluded from consideration in the way the manual instructs.
We don't have issues with that warranting diligent investigation, and if it shows something that adheres to the real property or makes the sale not for market value, then
I'm not talking about investigation. I'm talking about the principle of law.
I think that is far less problematic, and I don't think there's necessarily an issue with being cautious of that, as opposed to if it's vacant, you can't use it. So that is different than the primary issue raised by the court.
So the only issue that the big issue you identify is this sort of, constantly the briefing frame it as a sort of categorical exclusion of any property that's vacant some of the amici, I guess, discuss that too and raise some hypotheticals of currently vacant properties that might not meet the definition of dark and maybe shouldn't be excluded. Where do you get the principle that those things could never, under any circumstances, be excluded? I'm not sure where that is here.
So I think, Your Honor, that the principle is that vacancy in and of itself cannot provide a basis for exclusion. I'm not saying that a vacant sale cannot be used because there's problems.
Can you point me to where you see that specific argument being made?
In what context,
Your Honor? In anywhere in this. Just in the trial court, in the manual in particular, I guess, I'm trying to figure out, a lot of your argument is premised upon this, rejecting this categorical, any property that's currently vacant gets excluded. In reading through the materials, I didn't see where anybody was making that argument other than you're arguing against it. And I may have missed it, so I'm happy to be pointed to it, but where specifically are you asking us to, who's making that argument that we need to correct?
Yeah, so admittedly, the focus did change somewhat when it came up to the Court of Appeals, Your Honor. There were arguments regarding this dark store issue below. The primary issue raised on the initial appeal was there were still improper summary dismissals and not proper consideration of the Tier 2 evidence, not proper application of standards. Just to speak to some of the evidence, Your Honor, regarding the two sales that were dark, Mr. Maroos talked about how those weren't necessarily outside the range of the locality that they were in. He talked in detail about how he investigated the sales, how there was no actual distress or undue duress. And then the other...
I get it, and I've read the materials, and I understand your argument that you think the trial court made some poor factual findings there, okay? And I understand that. I didn't see the trial court saying... these properties currently have no lease or nobody in them, therefore they're excluded. The trial court didn't do that.
So it was a different approach by the trial court. I think it did bleed into the dark property conversation and the evaluation of that, Your Honor. I think it also came up in the section about the business concern. But yet the Court of Appeals is what really brought that specific issue to the fore. So that is acknowledged. And there are other issues and there were other discrete issues raised on appeal that didn't necessarily warrant this court's attention, frankly. And the big problem is the perceived rule of law that drove the Court of Appeals evaluation of what the circuit court did and how it evaluated evidence and essentially said, okay, in response to these aren't distressed, these aren't dark, they shouldn't be categorically disqualified. The Court of Appeals said, you're missing the point. This isn't apples to apples. You cannot use vacant properties. This is derived from bond stores. And so that's how the principle
comes
in. Could
you point to exactly where in the Court of Appeals opinion it said that?
So, Your Honor, this is... So it's cited in our brief, Your Honor, but I'm opening to the... Your Honor, paragraph 32 is one that, and there were several different spots that were cited in the briefing. Paragraph 32, and this is with regard to the so-called dark properties, Your Honor. It is undisputed that as of the valuation dates, the Lowe's property was not vacant, was not transitioned to another use, and was operating in stable condition. Yet, Mr. Maroos selected sales of properties to compare to the subject in Delavan that were vacant or dark. His analysis does not present an apples-to-apples comparison. And the court does use vacant and dark synonymously in this.
And so if this had just said dark, you'd be fine with that as a principle?
It wouldn't be as problematic, Your Honor. There would still be the errors on appeal that were brought up, but what jumped out...
What do you mean as a principle of law? Would you say it wouldn't be as problematic? What would be the problem with it if it just said dark?
If there's a categorical exclusion, because the definition of dark is vague and it requires investigation into what does dark mean? Does it disqualify the sale? You can't say, it was on the market it was vacant for 3.5 years and it's typical for three. It's kind of this is all totality of circumstances.
Sure. Fact specific.
Yep. But the most problematic part is the Court of Appeals ruling. And that comes up in the distressed property discussion, too, where it repeats that conclusion. And that's where the language is. So the Lowe says that and refers to this evidence that It was not actually distressed. These were good market value sales, good locations. They continued retail operations after it was bought by a retailer. It wasn't vacant for long. And the court said that misses the point. It did kind of shift on its way up, Your Honor, admittedly. And that's the primary issue before the court. And so I guess to put it in context of the appeal, the first question, I guess, that we presented for review is that pure question of law, that the Court of Appeals categorical disqualification is incorrect. And I think as applied to this case, Your Honor, and as it impacts this case, as much as we would like the court to dictate an ultimate conclusion that the assessment was excessive, that there is errors of law and the fundamental principles weren't properly applied below, and in combination with rebutting the presumption through it's a separate basis to rebut the presumption, Your Honor, it's set forth in Walgreen-Madison if it didn't comply with the manual, and that has been a separate basis for reversal and remand in several other cases. So we think that the law, essentially, that was applied, the valuation principles, weren't proper. So we asked
what
the court
rule of law are you asking us? I understand your argument. I'm not sure I agree with it, but I understand your argument as far as what you're saying the Court of Appeals did wrong, and I've got paragraph 32 in front of me. What rule of law are you asking us?
I guess asking the court to reject the bright line rule of law.
I'll say it in the negatives. I get what right. Like I know what you don't want.
Yeah.
What do you? You're concerned about the bright line. I got that. Is there any line? What if a store has been, dark for, I don't know, whatever, 10, 15, 20 years? I mean, is there any line?
Your Honor, I think it's that vacant sales, just by virtue of vacancy, should not be disqualified, and they can be good comparables in a Tier 2 setting. And I guess to tie it into another point of our briefing is, and basic standard, is that assessment should be no higher than what a property owner can actually sell their property for. There is a fundamental element of comparison is the real property rights conveyed, whether it's actually a fee simple sale. So what's happening with this rule, if this bright line rule is allowed to stand and spread, is that it essentially disqualifies potentially an entire category of potentially good evidence and relegates either Tier 2 analyses to least fee sales, which can be used, but the court in Walgreen-Madison said that can skew it from fee simple value, and that warrants additional consideration, investigation, and unreliability concerns. So I think if it were just stated very broadly, Justice Kurofsky, is that just because a sale is vacant, it can still potentially be a good Tier 2 comparable sale, and that's what other jurisdictions have said in applying the same principles, is that they're not disqualified. They can reflect the fee simple market value, which is all that is to be measured, and to take into account occupancy as a disqualifying factor, that injects business value, the value that is attributable to a business being on the property.
Please go ahead.
Thank you. I want to return to your paragraph 32, which you just read. Do you agree, as the Court of Appeals stated and you just read in paragraph 32, do you agree it's undisputed that as of the valuation dates, the Lowe's property was not vacant, was not in transition to another use, and was operating in a stable condition? Do you agree to that?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. You then say that the guts or the essence of your argument is that I think it lies in the word or, as you read it in paragraph 32. Maru selected sales of property to compare to the subject property in Delavan that were vacant or dark. Now, or, a conjunction, can mean synonymous or it can mean something totally different as an alternative. You're interpreting the Court of Appeals or to mean synonymous. Why?
And Your Honor, Justice Ann Bradley, I think maybe 35, it's paragraph 35 of the Court of Appeals decision put. And this is in response to that Mr. Maroos didn't use distressed sales. Lowe's argument fails because it's contrary to the manual's explicit directive that the assessor should avoid using sales of improved properties that are vacant with, in paren, dark, used synonymously.
And indeed, that's exactly where I thought you would go, because in my opinion, the Court of Appeals, in doing in paragraph 35 the parentheses, is in contradiction to the terms of the manual, which I'm speaking at, you have in your appendix at page 133, that portion of the manual.
I agree, Your Honor, is that the manual, the Court of Appeals notes that the portion of the manual that does not describe its vacancy synonymously with dark, but as applied here, there's no, under that definition of dark in the manual, there's no dispute that four of these sales, again, we said that Mr. Maroos explained how the other two were not as well, but four of them were not dark under that definition in the manual. So to apply this exclusionary rule to these sales, Your Honor, it's necessarily using the terms synonymously, because these properties, and Mr. Maroos talked specifically that they were vacant for a period of months. These were good locations, high demand, retailer bottom, they were not dark under that definition of the manual that's contained in the manual at one point. So that is, I think, a clear legal rule that the court is perceiving on stores. And if nothing else, the first point is clarification and perfection of that rule.
Can we get into some examples just so I'm clear about what your argument is? Are you talking specifically about the American TV locations? Because American TV went out of business because it had business problems. And if I'm understanding your argument correctly, you're saying that just because a particular business went out of business doesn't mean that the value of the real estate that they formerly occupied doesn't have value in American TV's situation, perhaps for another type of retailer or for warehousing or something. Is that the gist of your argument?
Justice Rebecca Bradley, my light went red, but I can just say yes.
Well, that was great. All right. We'll have 5 minutes on rebuttal.
Morning. May it please the court. Attorney Danielle Tierney of Axley Brennelson, along with co-counsel who's seated behind me, Lori Lubinsky, for the City of Delavan. I want to start by first addressing Justice Rogensack's first question, which was, what evidence was presented to show that this assessment was excessive? Because I think that really is dispositive of this whole case. While the petitioner is challenging legal theories that arguably weren't even applied in this case, what this case really boils down to is the petitioner's challenge to the factual and the credibility, the factual findings and the credibility assessments of the circuit court. Justice Hagedorn, I think you acknowledged that as well in your questioning, which is petitioner obviously has issues with those and challenges those. But in order for the court to address the question as presented by the petitioner, we have to assume that factual findings that were made that were not in fact made. There was no, we can be clear, there was no categorical exclusion of comparable properties simply because they were vacant.
Did the Court of Appeals speak too broadly in paragraph 37 when it said under Wisconsin law, Maroos's use of vacant in transition and distressed properties to value Lowe's property is a fundamental and overarching fatal flaw in the Tier 2 valuation? Because I think you would concede, wouldn't you, that just because a property is vacant doesn't mean that it's not comparable, using the example of American TV. American TV went out of business not because the areas in which it resided were in distress or not desirable areas. It had a problem with its business model, generally speaking. So just because American TV went out of business doesn't mean that that should affect the value of the real estate. The real estate, and it may or may not be, you know, in this case, but the real estate itself could have a lot of value, notwithstanding the fact that American TV couldn't make a go of its business.
It could. I think that's a different question, though. That deals with a distressed sale, which in and of itself the court had noted, the circuit court had noted in its factual findings, was not, there was not enough evidence presented by Lowe's regarding the nature of that distressed sale to allow the court to feel comfortable that that was the most amount that the real estate could be sold for. Because it was in a receivership, because the sale did go through so quickly, the circuit court noted that it did not have enough information to confirm that those sales could be comparable because of the nature of the sale. However, if you're asking whether or not the American TV properties could be considered, notwithstanding the receivership issue, if they were just looking at the vacancy issue, we would agree that just because they were vacant does not necessarily disqualify them.
Thank you.
And I don't think there is this bright line categorical exclusion. I think Justice Hagedorn, when you had asked for that, I don't think petitioner has provided any information to indicate that there is this bright line rule. Underlying the challenge are these challenges to the credibility assessments and the challenges to the factual findings. The trial court made a factual finding using the definition in the manual that two of the properties were indeed dark. It is not an exclusion just because they're vacant. They are dark, and the court, because of the principles set forth in the manual, established that those are not comparable sales.
So just to make sure I understand where the lay of the land here, one of the hypotheticals that was in the briefing, for example, say you have a new development that's not currently occupied. Could that conceivably be a property that is reasonably comparable and incorporated into a proper Tier 2 assessment, even though it's currently vacant in the very literal sense of the word? And your answer to the question is, yes, it could, under the circumstances. So are we in heated agreement over the main dispute about this?
I think so, because I think you hit the nail on the head. Just because something is vacant does not mean it's necessarily excluded. Another example being a business that's used as a restaurant. Just because one restaurant goes under doesn't mean, and the property is sold and vacant, sold to another restaurant, just because the sale or the property was vacant at the time of the sale does not categorically exclude that property from a comparable.
But doesn't it exclude it if the subject property is not likewise vacant?
It does not. No, there is no bright line rule that says vacant properties cannot be used. The manual does encourage assessors to look at properties that are not distressed, in transition, or sales that are otherwise dark, in transition, or otherwise distressed. And the
you want to ask about it? I mean, ask about it. All right. So along this point, I agree with you to the extent that the manual still exists as is. It seems that that is what it says. There is a new version, from what I understand, coming out, which seems to make vacancy and dark to make that a little bit less clear. So what the new manual says, and I hope you know about it and that you can address it. It says the assessor should avoid using sales of improved properties that are vacant or distressed as comparable sales unless the subject property is similarly vacant or distressed. Vacant or non-operating stores are often referred to as dark stores. So this makes really unclear, I think, the distinction between distressed versus vacant. What do you say to the new language?
Unfortunately, I don't have a response to the new manual. I'd be happy to provide some supplementation, but I think there are other portions of the manual which provide a sufficient description for what a dark property is.
But for our purposes, you would like us to make a distinction between dark versus vacant.
Well, I think the fundamental issue is that the manual doesn't say that the assessor cannot use those properties. It says that they should avoid, meaning there is no categorical bar, and there are indeed exceptions where such vacant or dark or distressed properties could perhaps be included.
Well, how does your argument differ from Lowe's argument then when I asked them what the rule is? Is it the same?
I'm sorry, could you please repeat that?
How does your argument differ from what Lowe's is arguing? I asked them what they were asking us, what kind of rule they wanted. And I think it's what you just said, that they don't want a categorical exclusion for dark, distressed, vacant stores. Are you asking us, what are you asking that is different than what they are asking?
Well, if I heard petitioner correctly, they were not asking their ask did not extend to dark and distressed. They said we don't want a categorical bar on vacant properties.
Is the gist of your argument then that maybe there isn't that much disagreement about what the law says? The disagreement is over whether Lowe's produce sufficient evidence to overcome the presumption of correctness?
I would agree to that. I think the law is settled that the challenger has to provide and present sufficient evidence that other properties were factual findings that these properties were, in fact, not comparable for the reason.
Generally, we don't take, when the law is settled, we don't take cases on sufficiency of evidence, but that's your main argument here?
Well, I don't want to comment on why the court may have taken this case.
Fair enough. Let me say, I disagree with your interpretation. And so I want you to push back. The manual that's set forth on Lowe's Appendix 133 was revised in 2015. I understand the new manual, and my understanding may or may not be correct. It says that it was revised on 12/20, that is December of 2020. And when I read the Appendix 133, I read that manual provision, because you want to compare apples and apples. I read it to mean that you can use vacant all you want, as long as the subject property is also vacant. I think that that provision is subject to a different interpretation also. My interpretation is what I said. And then, lo and behold, in the what looks like the proposed revision of 1220, it's consistent with my understanding. It says specifically that you can't use vacant as a comparable unless the subject property is also vacant. And, of course, we have a statute and a multitude of cases that say that it should interpretation should be consistent with the manual. Use the manual. You know the statute I'm referring to. It was cited several times here. It's always cited. So that's what the manual says. That's what my interpretation of the 2015 manual said, although I agree it can be subject to a different interpretation. But I don't think the 2020 manual is subject to different interpretation. It explicitly says the assessor should avoid using the sale of improved properties that are vacant or distressed as comparable sales unless the subject property is similarly vacant or distressed. Amen.
Well, I think, again, as I indicated in my prior answer, it's not an absolute categorical bar. I agree that it is strong language or discouraging the use.
Well, what part of the sentence that I just read indicates that has a caveat that says, but sometimes we don't mean it?
Well, I believe I don't have the provision in front of me, but we believe you said should use.
Assessors should avoid using sales of improved properties that are vacant or distressed as comparable sales unless the subject property is similarly vacant or distressed. And so you're saying should means they can if they want to.
Yes, I read should. I think should in this case is read more so along the line may or may not, as opposed to shall.
That's one of the problems with the ambiguity of words. When I say to you, if you were a fourth grader and you were being naughty, and I would say, you should not do that. You think that's, you may, if you don't want to, you can?
Perhaps in a different context. I think in this context, though, the manual provides a broader spectrum. But I think the underlying issue that needs to be remembered is why vacancy is a consideration, because the assessor is trying to look for the highest and best use of the property. And I don't think that was necessarily fully fleshed out as it should. I believe that the vacancy question goes to determining that highest and best use. If you've got a property that perhaps is in transition, it is vacant, that may be an indication that the highest and best use of the comparable property that we're looking at is changing. And when we're comparing and looking for the apples to apples comparison between the properties, you need to have similar highest and best use. And the vacancy goes to determining whether or not that highest and best use of the former Lowe's or the former Target or the former Walmart is still in fact the highest best use of that property, such that it can be compared to a current Lowe's. And that gets...
Because just because a business goes out of business, they could have a piece of property in a really hot area. I'll use an example that comes to mind, Sam's Club in Waukesha. Hot piece of property, Sam's Club goes out of business. Costco would be happy to come in because it doesn't have a location or a store near there. Just because it might be vacant for a few months while sales are negotiated, that doesn't mean that the value of the real estate is necessarily lower than a property that's occupied at the time of sale, right?
And we agree with that 100%, and I think that's a prime example of when vacant properties could be used as comparables. And just because the property is vacant at the time doesn't mean it shouldn't be excluded. Presumably, in that hypothetical, the vacancy period is going to be short, which goes to the definition of dark that was used in this case, pursuant to the manual, that dark is defined as a property that's vacant beyond the normal market conditions. And again, if it's vacant for longer, if Walmart in Waukesha goes out of business and it's vacant for 2 years, that's probably an indication for the assessor to look at and determine, well, maybe that property no longer, its highest and best use is no longer a general retail store. Perhaps a go-kart facility is going to come in that lowers the value of the property because going to be lower. There's going to need to be improvements and adjustments. But the underlying issue there is the vacancy goes to show what the highest and best use is. If the vacancy period is short, it's an indication that the highest and best use is going to remain the same. If the vacancy period is longer, the property sits vacant, there's no buyer, that's an indication that the market has indicated the highest and best use has changed, the property valuation is likely lower. So I think the fundamental question, I understand that the petitioners had raised the question on review whether or not a fee simple market valuation of retail property can be determined based on the sales of reasonably comparable properties that are vacant but do not constitute sales under duress or distress sales, or are all sales of property which are merely vacant at the time of sale per se disqualified as dark stores. Given that this case did not involve properties that were disqualified based on vacancy, they were found to not be comparable based on the evidence presented, that they were dark pursuant to the definition of the manual, that they were distressed based on a determination that the properties were in receivership, and based on Lowe's failure to present additional evidence that they were sufficiently comparable. The proper question raised is simply whether vacancy can be considered in an assessment, and the answer is yes. I see I have a few minutes left here, so I do want to address the second issue very briefly that was raised by Lowe's. The second question that they raised was, when does a presumption of correctness attach to a property assessment as a threshold matter, and what responsibility does a statutory assessor bear in a tax assessment challenge to demonstrate otherwise? I believe this question, and it may not have gotten as much attention, because I think this is settled by the law. The statute very clearly indicates that upon the assessor filing the necessary information with the affidavit, the presumption stands. It immediately attaches. There's no question about that. That's been repeated in case law at the Court of Appeals and at this level ad nauseum. I think the argument that the petitioner is trying to raise is a new argument saying that the assessor has to do more to prove the presumption just because the challenger says, I don't believe you.
Why is the $4.6 million assessment that opposing counsel brought up to me when I asked, well, what evidence is there to show that the property assessment was excessive? Why isn't that sufficient?
It was insufficient because the trial court explicitly made a credibility determination of the evidence that was presented, that Lowe's evidence was, quote, significantly less credible than the evidence presented by the city.
Okay, so you're just riding on the presumption. You got to get, what, over half if it's going to rebut the presumption, or what's the amount of certainty that one has to have to meet or exceed the presumption?
Well, in order to rebut the presumption, case law is clear that the challenger has to provide significant contrary evidence that the assessment is excessive.
Okay. So there's no particular benchmark of a certain percentage.
Correct. It really comes down to the trial court making a credibility determination based on the evidence and facts provided. And I think that determination by the trial court is dispositive of the issue. While they may say, well, we think we beat the presumption, we think we brought significant evidence, the trial court explicitly said your evidence was significantly less credible.
So are you saying that the presumption attaches at the time the assessor files the information along with the affidavit, there doesn't need to be any compliance with the manual?
The statute makes clear that the presumption immediately applies. However, a challenger, if they present significant contrary evidence that the assessor did not comply with the statute, I would agree that then the presumption does not apply. That is in the case law that has been already addressed by this court. I believe it's the Adams outdoor case. Which explicitly said that no presumption of correctness may be accorded to an assessment that does not apply the principles in the property assessment manual. But in that case, the challenger provided significant evidence to show that the assessment that was done by the assessor did not comply with the Wisconsin manual. So it does apply initially. There's an ability for the challenger to show that it should not apply. So you start with the presumption. If the petitioner provides significant contrary evidence, it's up to the court to decide whether or not that evidence demonstrated that they didn't comply with the law. And in this case, again, this goes to a factual challenge that the petitioner obviously has an issue with, but the court made individual factual determinations that this court can rely upon to then apply the law and conclude that the assessor did, in fact, comply with the manual. Specifically, there was a factual finding that there was an independent analysis done by the assessor for 16 and 17. There was a factual finding that the 2013 assessment was based on a cost approach. And I see my time is up, but I would just note that there are factual findings that the court should rely upon.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Amy Seibel, and I'm representing the League of Wisconsin Municipalities. I wrote the amicus brief that has been presented in this case. And the reason that the League asked for time to speak today, and we appreciate the court allowing us to speak today, is that this issue is affecting cities, villages, and towns throughout the state. There has been an immense amount of litigation, and we are all looking forward to getting some clarification from this court on the dark store theory.
So the dark stores theory is what is troubling the people who are members of the League?
Well, the League has as its members the municipalities, and the municipalities are grappling with how to defend assessments.
But is that the focus that you want us to direct our attention to, the dark store issue?
Well, I believe it's all connected, and I will tell you why. And it's not just dark store, it's dark properties. These same theories that have been promoted affect manufacturing properties, industrial properties. It affects really all types of properties in the state. And the question is, I believe the bond store decision. And by the way, I do have some particular knowledge about the bond store decision because I represented the city of Wauwatosa in that case. And also I represented the city of Wauwatosa in the Lowe's case, which is cited by the Court of Appeals in the Delavan case. The bond store decision is really about highest and best use. And what are the proper comparable sales to select when valuing the subject property? And I know there were a lot of questions this morning by the court about whether just this, the status of being vacant is all that the assessor should look at. Actually, the status of being vacant addresses whether the property is stabilized, because properties should be valued based on the condition in which they exist on the assessment date. And that can change from year to year. And so if on the assessment date the property is stabilized, meaning occupied, and there's no evidence to suggest that that property, that condition is going to change so that the property would be in transition, there's really no reason to look at vacant properties, vacant sale properties, because those properties were not in a stable condition at the time of sale.
Counsel, do you disagree with the general principles that were outlined by the city here, that there could be some instances where a vacant property could be used? Do you disagree with that proposition for an occupied property?
Yes, I don't disagree with it, because when you look at a vacant property, you have to look at the conditions under which the property sold. So if the property was sold and it was converted to a different use, there are sometimes can be huge conversion costs associated with how the property is priced in the sale. But I've seen examples, and I do a lot of property tax work from across the state, and so I've seen examples where a grocery store is sold. It needs some updating, and the present owner doesn't want to put the time and expense into updating the grocery store, and they sell it to another grocery store operator. There's no problem with using that sale. And then you just make appropriate adjustments for the condition of the property at the time of sale. Needed updating. So I disagree with counsel for Lowe's that the bond store decision created a bright line test that vacant properties could never be used. But what the manual does say is that when valuing a stabilized retail property, assessors should choose comparable sales exhibiting similar highest and best use and similar placement in the retail marketplace. And as we stated in our amicus brief, market segmentation is a very big analysis that assessors should do, because if we have a market-based system, as we do, assessors and appraisers need to look to the marketplace to see how properties are being handled with sale prices. And if a property is occupied, it shows that there is demand for that current use. And therefore, if that current use, there's demand by the marketplace, then the way the property is designed for that use should be considered by the assessor.
Can I just make sure? I want to make sure I understand sort of that. What you have is almost like these competing economic theories here, right? Because Lowe's does make some arguments, so they didn't present much here today, but they sort of suggest that we really should be looking at vacant properties in a much more expansive way. They at least suggest that, and particularly their reliance on the Walgreens case. What I hear you saying, and what I think the manual at least reflects, is that while maybe a vacant property could be utilized in some circumstances, that properties that are occupied reflect market realities, and those market realities are going to be reflective of the highest and best use, and that's not taking into account the business itself. It's taking into account the highest and best use, and therefore it is the more appropriate apples-to-apples comparison. And when you take out when a property is not occupied, you've got less reason to believe that those same market principles are at work, at least if it's been out for a particular period of time.
I would agree with that, and because you have the benefit when you have a sale of a vacant property, you know the use to which it's going to be put. And so if you have a vacant property that sells, like several of the comparable sales that Lowe's used, if it's going to be put to become a go-kart, indoor go-kart operation, well, clearly that has a different highest and best use than a home improvement store. And so when you look at a vacant sale, you look at the former use does not matter. If it was formerly And that was another one of the comparables. The Lowe's and Brown Deere was formerly a home improvement store, and it was sold and became a Walmart, which is a different highest and best use. A Walmart is part general merchandise and part grocery store. And there was significant money, $6 million, put into the Lowe's store to convert it, because it was a property in transition, to convert it to a different highest and best use. And so that's the problem. And so it speaks to the question of whether these vacant properties are truly comparable, because they don't share the same highest and best use after the sale and based on the price for which it was paid, because all that gets built into the price that's paid. Or it may not have a similar placement in the marketplace. Did that answer your question?
Yeah, thank you.
So markets are always forward-looking, and that's why you have to look to the use to which the sale property is going to be put to see if there's any market indications that the subject property is going to be put to that same similar market. And by the way, the manual talks about submarkets, which was the Nestle decision from this court. The court said that in determining highest and best use, you get as narrow as the market will support. And therefore, there's a lot of information now in the manual and in appraisal theory as far as looking at not only the market, which might be as broad as retail, but it might be the specific submarket within the retail category. I've seen examples where comparable sales have been used by opposing appraisers, where it's formerly retail and it becomes a funeral home, or it becomes an indoor soccer facility. I would suggest to you that, and in those cases that I'm speaking of, the court rejected those as comparable sales because they don't have a similar highest and best use to the current use, which the market is supporting for the subject property. I just want to take a few minutes to talk about, because I think it's important, this distinction between fee simple and leased fee. While I agree that it's a different case, I can tell you from my experience in representing municipalities in the years since the Walgreens decision was rendered that it has been misapplied in ways that I don't believe the court ever intended. I don't believe that the court said, and specifically in paragraph 84, did not say that a fee simple means that a property has to be valued as if it is available, vacant and available to be leased. The court never said that. In fact, the court said that if the contract rents under the lease are at market levels, then the contract rents do determine the fee simple market value of the property. Fee simple is a legal term, and the existence of a lease does not destroy the fee simple interest that the owner has.
I don't recall Walgreens saying what you just said it says. I looked at Walgreens as a two-part case. Part of the valuation was because of the contract, and part of the valuation was because of the fee simple interest. If you can refer that to me, I will go back and reread Walgreens, because apparently I need to do that. Can you tell me where that is?
Yes, I believe it's paragraph 84.
84, okay, super. Thank you very much.
And I'm sorry, my time is up.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. In reply, I want to address, I guess, three or four broad issues. The first is that it seems like the primary legal issue that the briefing focused on and what we were fighting about, there seems to be agreement on it and concession on both the city's and the league's part, that the bright line rule that I do think was clearly announced here and applied by the Court of Appeals, that categorically excludes and prohibits fake and sales is not right. And it's important here because that's what was applied. It influenced the evaluation of all the Tier 2 evidence, all of Mr. Marusa's sales, all of Mr. Chapko's sales in the Court of Appeals opinion too. And there were other issues raised below the circuit court, but that is an important issue in this case, and it seems like if you look at the briefing, we have concessions that of arguments that shouldn't be a rule of law, and we agree with that. Also warrants this court's just confirmation of that fact, particularly Justice Dallet, you noted that there's inconsistent language in the new manual that seems to be adopting a rule that no one here believes should be Wisconsin law.
I'm going to throw water on your victory gap here because I thought that you did not accurately portray the holding of the Court of Appeals when you said it was a bright line rule that always excluded vacant property, no matter what. I didn't read the Court of Appeals that way, but you do.
I do think that there are statements repeated in that decision that indicate, yeah, Honor, when you're applying to owner-occupied properties, and it seems to be concession that should not be the case. So nothing else for as far as this principle will extend, because as the league reference, this is something that will extend to other types of properties. So it seems like we're in agreement on that. And that moves into the second issue I want to address, which is the highest and best use. This vacancy disqualification cropped up there in the Court of Appeals decision, refer to paragraphs 37 and 38, where the Court of Appeals perceived, again, some exclusionary quality to there not being a business in the property when it's sold. And Justice Rebecca Bradley, I think to go back to your point, the highest and best use, say, for an example, American TV moves out for business reasons, Steinhoffels moves in, it's vacant, naturally, that happens in a fee simple sale. The highest and best use throughout that entire process can be big box retail. With respect to the collateral argument made by the league that there's the highest and best use should be for a Lowe's improvement store in this case, I do want to note one fact, that is record item 151, day 3 of trial, page 72. When Mr. Chapko, the city's appraiser, was asked what the highest and best use of the property, what is the highest and best use as a retail big box? So that collateral argument is inconsistent with the city's own expert. The highest and best use issue, same with the a Lowe's property that sells to retail big box, can be the highest and best use. The fact that there isn't a user there at a particular is not disqualifying. Sorry.
Yeah, sorry. So just to clarify, the even if there's general agreement that a vacant store could be reasonably comparable, I think the manual seems to suggest that the market economics of a vacant property versus an occupied property are generally speaking not going to be the same, and therefore it's discouraged, at least insofar as it's been vacant for some extended period of time. Do you disagree with that?
Yeah, I think I do, Your Honor. It's vacancy cannot be a proxy for actual attributes that affect the real property. So in and of itself, it is not necessarily meaningful and it doesn't dictate anything because you need to look at location. Vacancy could say something about a property, and we're not saying you can't consider it. But in and of itself, if there's a business that decides to sell its property on the market, a fee simple sale, that could be a good comparable sale. It could check all the boxes. And then to get into the least fee simple issue, if you are using least fee sales, and Justice Rogensack, I think this does go directly back to Walgreens-Madison, where the court advised that there are conditions of a lease that brings it out of fee simple, and that can skew a value from fee simple value, any of these terms of the lease, any characteristics of the lease arrangement. So to go back to, yes, vacant properties can be good. They could potentially be the best comparables. If you're just looking at leased fee properties, that raises unreliability concerns. And the argument that they're the same interests, I don't think that's fairly arguable based on Walgreens-Madison. The last thing, my red light is up, so thank you.
Thank you. All right. Thank you for the interesting oral argument. Court will convene in closed conference at 1:30. We're adjourned.